Last October, I received an email from a gentleman I don't know, a gentleman from Gujarat. The email informed me that it had been decided that the centenary of Sri Aurobindo's realization of the silent Brahman would be celebrated by all the Sri Aurobindo centers of Gujarat on the 5th and 6th of January, that was Saturday and Sunday, and that a souvenir volume was being prepared for which he requested I should contribute an article. So I was puzzled. I was really puzzled. Of course, I'd heard of this major realization of Sri Aurobindo's and that it was, in a way, the start of his sadhana. I knew that it had happened in Baroda. I had always assumed that it had taken place during Sri Aurobindo's stay in what is now the Sri Aurobindo Nivas, the house he lived in during his stay in Baroda. He was there for 13 years, after all, from 1893 to 1906, he lived in Baroda. And when Nargis and I were involved in the first fundraising for Savitri Bhavan, we were invited to stay in the Sri Aurobindo Nivas, and we were given VVIP treatment there. We were lodged in the room between where Pujalal had stayed and the one where Champaklal had stayed. And we were given a tour of all the premises, and we were shown the apartments where Sri Aurobindo lived, which are now kept open for meditation. And very, very proudly, they showed us recently acquired the swing with beautiful iron chains on which Sri Aurobindo had sat when he was meditating with Lele. But they did explain, they said that didn't happen in that house. It had happened in another house, and that the owners of that house had been very reluctant to part with the swing, but finally it had come to Sri Aurobindo Nivas and they kept it in a special place there. I knew that Sri Aurobindo had left Baroda in 1906 to take up the principalship of the first national college, Indian National College in Calcutta. So why was the centenary happening now in January 1908? And because I was puzzled, I set out to find the answer, first of all, to this question, and I got some very interesting surprises on the way. So I thought it would be nice to share part of that journey with you. So the first thing I did was I turned to volume 30, of the Sri Aurobindo Birth Centenary Library. It's the index and the glossary. This was published in 1972. Now, after 30 odd years, they're bringing out a definitive collected works of Sri Aurobindo, but it's not yet complete. The index is not yet complete. But that index to the Birth Centenary Library is a very, very useful volume, and it includes a chronology of Sri Aurobindo's life. So there I made my first startling discovery. It was that in December 1907, Sri Aurobindo was in full political action. He was moving around the country, giving speeches here and there. And on December 21st, he left Calcutta for Surat to attend the Indian National Congress. So those of us who know anything about Sri Aurobindo's life, we know that the Surat Congress was really a very, very important point in his political work. It was at that Congress that he and a small group of nationalists, extremist nationalists, revolutionaries, they disrupted the whole Congress, which was dominated by the so-called moderates, and insisted that the full independence of India had to be made the aim of the nationalist movement. So this happened in the last week of December, 1907. It's really, we can say, the pivotal point of Sri Aurobindo's work as a result of those few days that he spent in Surat. This objective, full independence, it was adopted as the aim of the nationalist movement and of the Indian National Congress. He continued with his political work, but if we look back, we can say that this was the real culminating point of it. Just a few days later, well, he left the Congress at on the 30th, 31st of December, I think. He remained in Surat from December 24th to 31st, and then he left for Baroda. Surat is in Gujarat, it's on the coast, and Baroda is inland. Perhaps it's about 4 or 5 hours by train journey now. I don't know how long it took in those days. And he had made an appointment to meet Vishnu Bhaskar Lele there. He no longer had his own home in Baroda, so they were received at a friend's house. So in the first week of January 2007, Sri Aurobindo stayed with Lele at that friend's house in Baroda, and then he traveled with Lele first to Pune and then to Bombay. And in Bombay, they parted company. Sri Aurobindo returned to Calcutta, and they met only once again, a few months later, at which time Lele, says Sri Aurobindo, was alarmed, tried to undo what he had done, and told me that it was not the divine, but the devil that had got hold of me. It's very interesting. So this momentous meeting happened in the first days of January 1908. So really now we are at the centenary of this very special event. So the next thing that I did, having established the chronology, was to see what Sri Aurobindo himself had said or written on various occasions about this event. In his letters on yoga, I found only a very few references to it, but one very significant one, which I intend to share with you a little later. But in the volume On Himself, that's volume 26 of the Birth Centenary Library, I found many more statements, some of which we can have a look at now. Some of these were letters, and some of them are passages dictated by Sri Aurobindo to correct or amplify statements that were made about him in public by other people. So this is one of those. It's a passage dictated by Sri Aurobindo. And it says, from 1904 onwards, Sri Aurobindo began practicing yoga on his own account, starting with pranayama, as explained to him by a friend. Afterwards, faced with difficulties, he took help of Lele, who was called for the purpose from Gwalior by Barindra, Sri Aurobindo's younger brother, who was involved with him in the revolutionary movement. This was after the Surat Congress in 1908. So Sri Aurobindo mentions this point in several of his letters or dictated clarifications, that he first started practicing sadhana in 1904, but that he wasn't able to make much progress, and that it was Lele who helped him to make the needed breakthrough in January 1908. Here's another passage dictated by Sri Aurobindo. Before he met Lele, Sri Aurobindo had some spiritual experiences, but that was before he knew anything about yoga or even what yoga was. For example, a vast calm which descended on him at the moment when he stepped first on Indian soil after his long absence. In fact, with his first step on the Apollo Banda in Bombay. You know, Sri Aurobindo left India when he was only 6.5, 7 years old, and he returned as a young man of 21. So at that moment of return, a feeling of vast calm descended on him with his first step on Indian soil. This calm surrounded him and remained for long months afterwards. Then he lists some of the other early experiences. The realization of the vacant infinite while walking on the ridge of the Takhti Suleiman in Kashmir. He's written poems about this, no? The living presence of Kali in a shrine on the banks of the Narmada. The vision of the Godhead surging up from within when he was in danger of a carriage accident in Baroda in the first year of his stay, etc., he adds. So we can identify sonnets of his about all these experiences. He says, but these were inner experiences coming of themselves and with a sudden unexpectedness, not part of a sadhana. He started yoga by himself without a guru, getting the rule from a friend, a disciple of Brahmananda of Gangamath. It was confined at first to assiduous practice of pranayama, breathing exercises, at one time for 6 hours or more a day. There was no conflict or wavering between yoga and politics. Somebody must have written something like that. He says there was nothing like that. When he started yoga, he carried on both without any idea of opposition between them. He wanted, however, to find a guru. He met a Naga sannyasi in the course of this search, but did not accept him as guru, though he was confirmed by him in a belief in yoga power when he saw him cure Barin in almost a moment of a violent and clinging hill fever. This is one of the colorful stories we have often heard, that Barin came home seriously ill with this fever, and that it continued for weeks and weeks on end. And this wandering Naga sannyasi, who carries a snake with him, cured him by giving a glass of water that he had cut through with a knife. He'd repeated silently a mantra, and Barin was immediately cured. And at that moment, Sri Aurobindo said that, I want this power for our political work. He saw him cure Barin in almost a moment of a violent and clinging hill fever by merely cutting through a glass full of water crosswise with a knife while he repeated a silent mantra. Barin drank and was cured. But he had no helper or guru in yoga till he met Lele. And that was only for a short time. So from the chronology, we've seen already that Sri Aurobindo was in full political action at the time that he met Lele. And it seems that he made clear to Lele right at the beginning what his aims were. When I told him that I wanted to do yoga, but for work, for action, not for sannyasa and nirvana, but after years of spiritual effort, I had failed to find the way, and it was for that I had asked to meet him. His first answer was, "It would be easy for you, as you are a poet." A poet. We can meditate on this answer. I don't know quite what Lele had in mind. Sri Aurobindo has also repeatedly spoken of the importance and value of this encounter for his development. For example, this dictated clarification. Sri Aurobindo never took any formal diksha from anyone. He started his sadhana at Baroda in 1904 on his own account after learning from a friend the ordinary formula of pranayama. Afterwards, the only help he received was from the Maharashtrian yogi Vishnu Bhaskar Lele, who instructed him how to reach complete silence of the mind and immobility of the whole consciousness. This Sri Aurobindo was able to achieve in 3 days, with the result of lasting and massive spiritual realizations, opening to him the larger ways of yoga. Lele finally told him to put himself entirely into the hands of the divine within and move only as he was moved. And then he would need no instructions, either from Lele himself or anyone else. This henceforward became the whole foundation and principle of Sri Aurobindo's sadhana. From that time onward, and through many years of intensive experience at Pondicherry, he underwent no spiritual influence from outside. So this experience of complete silence and immobility of the whole mind, whole consciousness, led Sri Aurobindo first to something which he calls the Brahman experience, the experience of the silent, all-pervading self. And he says, the Brahman experience came when I was groping for a way, doing no sadhana at all, making no effort because I didn't know what effort to make, all having failed. Then in 3 days, I got an experience which most yogis get only at the end of a long yoga experience. got it without wanting or trying after it, got it to the surprise of Lele, who was trying to get me something quite different. Lele was a bhakta. He was not an Advaitin. He was against Advaita Vedanta. He says, I was induced to meet a man without fame I didn't know, a bhakta with a limited mind, but with some experience and evocative power. We sat together, and I followed with an absolute fidelity what he instructed me to do, not myself in the least understanding where he was leading me or where I was myself going. The first result was a series of tremendously powerful experiences and radical changes of consciousness, which he had never intended, for they were Advaitic and Vedantic, and he was against Advaita Vedanta, and which were quite contrary to my own ideas. For they made me see with a stupendous intensity the world as a cinematographic play of vacant forms in the impersonal universality of the Absolute Brahman. The final upshot was that he was made by a voice within him to hand me over to the divine within me, enjoining an absolute surrender to its will. A principle, or rather a seed force, to which I kept unswervingly and increasingly, till it led me through all the mazes of an incalculable yogic development, bound by no single rule or style or dogma or shastra, to where and what I am now, and towards what shall be hereafter. The next letter I like to share with you because it's quite amusing. He says, in my own case, he's telling somebody that we can never really predict what the divine is going to do with us. No? So he says, in my own case, I owe the first decisive turn of my inner life to one who was infinitely inferior to me in intellect, education, and capacity, and by no means spiritually perfect or supreme. But having seen a power behind him decided to turn there for help, I gave myself entirely into his hands and followed with an automatic passivity the guidance. He himself was astonished and said to others that he had never met anyone before who could surrender himself so absolutely and without reserve or question to the guidance of the helper. The result was a series of transmuting experiences of such a radical character that he was unable to follow and had to tell me to give myself up in future to the guide within with the same completeness of surrender as I had shown to the human channel. So what was the method by which this extraordinary result was achieved? It is my great debt to Lele, says Sri Aurobindo, that he showed me this. Sit in meditation, he said, but do not think. Look only at your mind. You will see thoughts coming into it. Before they can enter, throw these away from your mind till your mind is capable of entire silence. I had never heard before of thoughts coming visibly into the mind from outside, but I didn't think of either of questioning the truth or the possibility. I simply sat down and did it. In a moment, my mind became silent as a windless air on a high mountain summit. And then I saw one thought and then another coming in a concrete way from outside. I flung them away before they could enter and take hold of the brain. And in 3 days, I was free. In another letter, he says, "Sit down, I was told. Look, and you will see that your thoughts come into you from outside. Before they enter, fling them back." I sat down and looked and saw to my astonishment that it was so. I saw and felt concretely the thought approaching as if to enter through or above the head, and was able to push it back concretely before it came inside. So this was the method. But what was the outcome? He says a series of experiences. No? One of the places where Sri Aurobindo expresses this series of experiences in most detail is in a letter he dictated in 1946 to be sent to the British writer Aldous Huxley, in response to a review the latter had written of Sri Aurobindo's book, The Life Divine. So there Sri Aurobindo states, "After 3 years of spiritual effort with only minor results, he, Sri Aurobindo, was shown by a yogi the way to silence his mind. This he succeeded in doing entirely in 2 or 3 days by following the method shown. There was an entire silence of thought and feeling, and all the ordinary movements of consciousness, except the perception and recognition of things around, without any accompanying concept or other reaction. The perception and recognition of things around without any accompanying concept or other reaction. The sense of ego disappeared, and the movements of the ordinary life, as well as speech and action, were carried on by some habitual activity of prakriti alone, which was not felt as belonging to oneself." So nobody noticed any difference, no? He went on making political speeches. He went on running a newspaper. He went on doing everything that had to be done. But he says this was not felt as being willed or planned or activated from himself. It was just the action of nature carrying on in its habitual groove. But the perception which remained saw all things as utterly unreal. This sense of unreality was overwhelming and universal. And elsewhere he says this lasted for some months. He saw everything just like a film going on. The experience of unreality. Of course, this is an experience which has been reported by many yogis and by many, it's considered to be the goal of the path. This is the so-called nirvana experience, or the in Vedanta, Vedantic path, Advaita Vedanta, moksha, liberation. You're liberated from the illusion of all the appearances of life. But after some time, some undefinable reality was perceived as true, which was beyond space and time and unconnected with any cosmic activity, but yet was met wherever one turned. So the whole world appeared unreal, but behind, beyond, some supreme reality which seemed beyond space and time and unconnected with any cosmic activity, with anything that was going on in the world. This condition remained unimpaired for several months. And even when the sense of unreality disappeared and there was a return to participation in the world consciousness, the inner peace and freedom which resulted, which resulted from the realization remained permanently behind all surface movements, and the essence of the realization itself was not lost. It was never lost. He always kept that silence of the mind, that freedom from illusions, the peace and the calm. At the same time, an experience intervened. Something else than himself took up his dynamic activity and spoke and acted through him, but without any personal thought or initiative. What this was remained unknown until Sri Aurobindo came to realize the dynamic side of the Brahman, the Ishvara, and felt himself moved by that in all his sadhana and action. These realizations and others which followed upon them, such as that of the self in all, and all in the self, and all as the self, the divine in all, and all in the divine. This is the realization which he had in Alipur jail. And perhaps I'm anticipating myself if I say that these experiences in Alipur jail, these took place within less than 2 years, within 12 months of this first experience. And by the time Sri Aurobindo left Calcutta for Chandanagar, this again is interesting from the chronological point of view, that was in February 1910. So just 2 years after this first realization. By that time, he had had all the realizations and experiences which laid the foundation of his later development of his own unique yoga. But he says the only real difficulty, which took decades of spiritual effort to work out towards completeness, was to apply the spiritual knowledge utterly to the world and to the surface psychological and outer life, and to effect its transformation, both on the higher levels of nature and on the ordinary mental, vital, and physical levels down to the subconscious and the basic inconscious, and up to the supreme truth consciousness or supermind, in which alone the dynamic transformation could be entirely integral and absolute. So these realizations came, the knowledge came, the basis was laid very rapidly, but he has emphasized in this late letter, November 1946, that the continuing spiritual effort that was needed to implement them, to work out the transformation which was implied by those experiences. I'd like to read another letter. Again, it gives some details about what the experience really was. My first major experience, radical and overwhelming, though not, as it turned out, final and exhaustive, came after and by the exclusion and silencing of all thought. There was first what might be called a spiritually substantial or concrete consciousness of stillness and silence. Then the awareness of some soul and supreme reality in whose presence things existed only as forms, but forms not at all substantial or real or concrete. But this was all apparent to a spiritual perception and essential and impersonal sense. And there was not the least concept or idea of reality or unreality or any other notion, for all concept or idea was hushed, or rather entirely absent in the absolute stillness. These things were known directly through the pure consciousness and not through the mind, so there was no need of concepts or words or names. In another letter, Sri Aurobindo mentions, such a realization does not usually come at the beginning of a sadhana, or in the first years, or for many years. It comes so to a very few. Mine came 15 years after my first pre-yogic experience in London, and in the fifth year after I started yoga. That I consider extraordinarily quick, an express train speed almost, although there may no doubt have been several quicker achievements. So when we look at another dictated account given by Sri Aurobindo of his development after this decisive opening, we are even more amazed, or I was even more amazed, at the express train speed with which the fundamental stages of his sadhana succeeded each other. Now I'm repeating. By the time that he left Calcutta for Chandanagar in February 1910, that is to say, only 2 years after the meeting with Lele, Sri Aurobindo, and these are his own words, had already realized in full two of the four great realizations on which his yoga and his spiritual philosophy are founded. The first he had gained while meditating with the Maharashtrian yogi Vishnu Bhaskar Lele at Baroda in January 1908. It was the realization of the silent, spaceless, and timeless Brahman, gained after a complete and abiding stillness of the whole consciousness, and attended at first by an overwhelming feeling and perception of the total unreality of the world. Though this feeling disappeared after his second realization, which was that of the cosmic consciousness and of the divine as all beings and all that is, which happened in the Alipore jail and of which he's spoken in his speech at Uttapara. To the other two realizations, that of the supreme reality with the static and the dynamic Brahman as its two aspects, and that of the higher planes of consciousness leading to the supermind, he was already on his way in his meditations in the Alipore jail. So I think that this brief overview of what Sri Aurobindo experienced in Baroda in the first week of January 2008 might convince us of the value of celebrating the centenary of the event, for it evidently opened up the way for all the fundamental realizations that became the basis for Sri Aurobindo's development of his own unique yoga. And without that, none of us would be sitting here today. No. So I'd like to close this first part of my presentation now by reading in full the very first letter which I came across in my search, and one which perhaps brings this topic closer to each one of us and provides a bridge to the second part of my talk. In this first letter, Sri Aurobindo wrote, "One cannot be a fully developed mental being if one has not a control of the thoughts, is not their observer, judge, master, the mental purusha, manomaya purusha, shakshi, anumanta, Ishvara. It is no more proper for the mental being to be the tennis ball of unruly and uncontrollable thoughts than to be a ship in the storm of the desires and passions, or a slave of either the inertia or the impulses of the body. It is more difficult because man, being primarily a creature of mental prakriti, identifies himself with the movements of his mind and cannot at once dissociate himself and stand free from the swirl and eddies of the mind whirlpool. It's comparatively easy for him to put a control on his body, at least on a certain part of his movements. It is less easy, but still very possible after a struggle, to put a mental control on his vital impulsions and desires. But to sit like the tantric yogi on the river above the whirlpool of his thoughts is less facile. Nevertheless, it can be done. All developed mental men, those who get beyond the average, have in one way or other, or at least at certain times and for certain purposes, to separate the two parts of the mind, the active part, which is a factory of thoughts, and the quiet, masterful part, which is at once a witness and a will. Observing them, judging, rejecting, eliminating, accepting, ordering corrections and changes, the master in the house of mind, capable of self-empire, Samraja. All developed mental men, at least, self-rule, self-samraja, self-empire. The yogi goes still further. He is not only a master there, but even while in mind, in a way, he gets out of it, as it were, and stands above or quite back from it and free. For him, the image of the factory of thoughts, the active mind at the front, is no longer quite valid. For he sees that thoughts come from outside, from the universal mind or universal nature, sometimes formed and distinct, sometimes unformed, and then they are given shape somewhere in us. The principal business of our mind is either a response of acceptance or a refusal to these thought waves, as also vital waves, subtle physical energy waves. It applies on the life level and the body level as well. Or this giving a personal mental form to thought stuff or vital movements from the environing nature force. And in Savitri, he says, we put our personal stamp on them, no? We get the things ready-made from somewhere else, put our personal stamp, send them out as individual products. So he says, it was my great debt to Lele that he showed me this. No? I've read it already. But he says, it's not to say that everybody can do it in the way that I did it, or with the same rapidity of the decisive movement. For, of course, the latter fullest developments of this new untrammeled mental power took time, many years. But a progressive freedom and mastery of one's mind is perfectly within the possibilities of anyone who has the faith and the will to undertake it. So that statement brings me to the second phase of my research, because something about that this letter reminded me strongly of some of the mother's talks. Indeed, she has taken up the topic of thought control in addressing many groups from her pre-Pondicherry days in Paris onwards. And I was specially reminded of her commentaries on the Dhammapada. After Sri Aurobindo left his body, the mother became more active than ever with the young people who were students in the ashram school, the institution she wanted to develop as the Sri Aurobindo International University Center, as a memorial to him and as a ground for the continuation of his work. And one of the first books she took up to read with them in French in her classes in the playground was a translation of the essential Buddhist text, the Dhammapada. And the first few verses of this scripture deal with the importance of mental control, not only for spiritual advancement, but for simple human happiness. And four main movements are mentioned, just the same ones that Sri Aurobindo mentions. First, observing one's thoughts, stepping back, separating oneself from one's thoughts in order to be able to see them. And then the second movement in in the translation that we have, it's called watching over. Mother said to discriminate, to distinguish between what is helpful and harmful, useful and not useful, between constructive thoughts that lead to victory and defeatist thoughts which turn us away from it. So some capacity of seeing where do the thoughts come from and what are they doing to us. So when we have seen that, the third step would be control. Once the enlightened judge of our consciousness has distinguished between useful and harmful thoughts, a kind of inner guard can come and allow to pass only approved thoughts, strictly refusing admission to all undesirable elements. With a commanding gesture, the guard will refuse entry to every bad thought and push it back as far as possible. So it's this movement of admission and refusal that we call thought control. And the ultimate development of thought control is mastery, when we think what we have to think. You know? So she encouraged her young students to practice these steps towards mental mastery. She said, "I believe it's a practice to be recommended to everyone to keep a certain time every day for trying to make the mind quiet, even, still." So I hope you would agree that there's a meaningful connection between these words of the mother and the letter of Sri Aurobindo. While the total silencing of the mind, which can bring the experience of the silent Brahman, is the exceptional achievement of those who are fit to undertake yoga practice, the first steps towards achieving the necessary mental mastery are not only within the reach of all somewhat developed mental beings. Being ready to take up such an effort is a mark of full humanity. The first two steps indicated by the mother in her commentaries on the Dhammapada are the steps of witnessing, first observing, then discriminating. Sri Aurobindo said a witness and a will. No? So the first two steps are functions of the witness, and the second two steps involve the will, controlling and practicing control until one attains complete mastery. So for those of you who have courage, patience to go a little further with me, I would like to take this exploration now into Savitri. Sri Aurobindo describes the experience of the silent self in several places in Savitri. But the place where this whole experience, with all the steps that we have noted in it, where it's evoked in most detail, it's in the Book of Yoga, in Canto 6, which is called Nirvana and the All-Negating Absolute. And it continues into Canto 7, the first part of Canto 7, the last canto of the Book of Yoga. We consider Savitri as Sri Aurobindo's spiritual autobiography, and particularly we identify his journey with the journey of King Asvapati. But these passages come in the Yoga of Savitri. And it's very interesting that all these steps, when we look closely, we will see all the steps are described in detail, at length, in these two cantos. First of all, Sri Aurobindo speaks about the realization of the silent, spaceless and timeless Brahman. No. And then he mentions it is nirvana. So it would be extremely interesting to make a minute comparison between all the phrases in Sri Aurobindo's letters and these lines of Savitri, and perhaps when I have more time or somebody has more time, we can do that. But we won't go into detail with it now. I would just like to mention 12 steps of the experience which I've identified, and which we can maybe just briefly have a look at the corresponding passages in Savitri. You know, Savitri has already discovered her psychic being, and then she has this devastating experience of some power, cosmic power, that seems to have the ability just to lay all her inner world waste. And then she's given a guidance that in order to fulfill your mission, you are going to have to lose all, you are going to have to expand your consciousness so much that whatever happens in the universe, even if the whole earth is just destroyed, it'll be just a tiny incident in a corner of it. And she's guided to look into herself. She bowed her head and mused, plunging her deep regard into herself, in her soul's privacy, in the silent night. Aloof and standing back, detached and calm, a witness of the drama of herself, a student of her own interior scene, she watched the passion and the toil of life, and heard in the crowded thoroughfares of mind the unceasing tread and passage of her thoughts. All she allowed to rise that chose to stir, calling, compelling naught, forbidding naught, she left all to the process formed in time and the free initiative of nature's will. Any of you who have practiced Buddhist meditation will recognize that this is practically the first step, no? To step back, not to exercise control, simply to observe. And after this observation process, she is able to distinguish what Sri Aurobindo calls the many births of thought. They come up from all over. They come up from the body, they come from this chakra, from that chakra, they come from outside. So seeing all those many, many births of thought, where all the different thoughts are coming from, she decides to exercise control. Only when we break through matter's wall, in that spiritual vastness can we stand, where we can live the masters of our world, and mind is only a means and body a tool. For above the birth of body and of thought, our spirit's truth lives in the naked self, and from that height, unbound, surveys the world. Out of the mind she rose to escape its law, that it might sleep in some deep shadow of self, or fall silent in the silence of the unseen. High she attained and stood from nature free and saw creation's life from far above. Thence upon all she laid her sovereign will to dedicate it to God's timeless calm. And with that laying on of the will, actually we see there are four stages. First of all, everything becomes quiet. Only sometimes little waves rise and fall. And yet this factory has stopped working. Nothing like that. The mind seems like a vast empty room. Sri Aurobindo says, "This men call quietude and prize as peace." But to her deeper sight, all yet was there, effervescing like a chaos under a lid. Feelings and thoughts cried out for word and act, but found no response in the silenced brain. So if the control is lifted, this is just going to explode, no? But as she goes on keeping the control, the will, this too paused. The body seemed a stone. All now was a wide, mighty vacancy, but still excluded from eternity's hush. Still was far the repose of the absolute and the ocean silence of infinity. Still some thoughts can come, and this is when she has the experience of the thoughts coming from the space outside. He uses a lovely image looking like ships approaching one by one a familiar port, ignorant of embargo and blockade, and then as they approach, boom, the will stops them. They sink. And again it comes, and again they're stopped. And when it has happened, sometimes then all grew still, nothing moved anymore. Immobile, self-wrapped, timeless, solitary, a silent spirit pervaded silent space. And then there's a long description of what Sri Aurobindo has mentioned in his letters, the sense of unreality and the recognition that Prakriti, nature, is just going on acting, keeping, doing all the necessary movements. I could just read a few lines which are very beautiful, the way that she sees the forest. All seemed a brilliant shadow of itself, a cosmic film of scenes and images. The enduring mass and outline of the hills was a design sketched on a silent mind and held to a tremulous false solidity by constant beads of visionary sight. The forest with its emerald multitudes, clothed with its show of hues, vague, empty space. A painting's colors hiding a surface void that flickered upon dissolution's edge. The blue heavens, an illusion of the eyes, roofed in the mind's illusion of a world. The men who walked beneath an unreal sky seemed mobile puppets out of cardboard cut and pushed by unseen hands across the soil, or moving pictures upon fancy's film. Yet, something was there behind the fading scene. Wherever she turned, at whatsoever she looked, it was perceived, yet hid from mind and sight. The one only real shut itself from space and stood aloof from the idea of time. There's this perception of that one reality, the only thing that makes sight, hearing, any of the senses worthwhile, and yet escapes from them completely, a supreme, unknowable reality. And concentrating on that, a formless liberation came on her. Once sepulchred alive in brain and flesh, she had risen up from body, mind, and life. She was no more a person in a world. She had escaped into infinity. And Sri Aurobindo describes how the whole individual being dissolves until there's only a faint record of a self now past, a vanishing vestige like a violet trace. She can see the possibility that this can just merge into that impersonal vastness. But she no longer has a personal will to decide whether to merge or not to merge. So the decision is left to that supreme reality. And in fact, she doesn't merge. She's kept for a long time, the end of Canto 6 into Canto 7, which describes how she's moving and living her life in the family, in the forest, discussing with the sages. Nobody notices any difference. Only sometimes when they are there meditating with the sages, if there's discourse, some incredible illumination seems to speak through her. This is this intervention that Sri Aurobindo spoke of, that something took up his words or his actions. He did things, he said, at which reason trembles, this experience. And this continues for quite a long time until one night, suddenly, a new voice comes which brings a new experience